You're listening to Buildopedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Buildopedia. Joining us today is a friend of Buildopedia and potentially someone who might help us with co-hosting some episodes down the track and even taking on some hosting, Andrew Durbridge. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Pleasure to be here. As always, I can say now.
Excellent. So, Andrew, you've been on a bit of a journey since we last spoke, or late last year. You've left your employer of many years and you've been on a journey and you're off on a new journey. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was pretty simple. I was one of the owners and directors at Partridge for 19 years, which was a great experience. And when I joined that company, there were 15 people. I think I was employee number 16 or something like that. And by late last year, we'd grown that practice to 82, 83 people. We had three offices in staff in three states and one territory. And it was just a very big beast and a different thing. And I started to, want to pine for being in a smaller organization. And I've done that exactly now. In fact, I'm in such a small operation. It's an office of one. So I've gone out on my own as a one-man band, and I'm now doing what I've always done and still very much in the high-end architectural space for residential houses and, alterations and additions and renovations and the like. But just now under my own little banner of AD consulting engineers.
There you go. And moving into podcasting as a career.
Yeah, well, I don't know about as a career, but certainly happy to stand behind a microphone.
Okay, fantastic. And you also went on a journey of sorts through Europe. Tell us what the highlights were.
Oh, look, as an engineer, going through Europe was amazing. My wife and I, we'd been to the UK plenty of times, and you'll know from my whiskey background, I've been to Scotland many times. So we'd never actually been to, I guess, what you call mainland Europe. So where we flew into Italy and basically went north from there. And as a structural engineer, like, you just walk around Rome and those places and, see these amazing structures that are still standing a couple of thousand years later and defying every single building code and a bit of logic that the universities tell us about today. And it's just inspiring, so inspiring to see these, the amazing craftsmanship that went into everything that they built and the beauty that was there, the architecture, the history as well. I mean, I've always, as a teenager, loved, the medieval stories and movies. And when you go to Europe and you see these castles and medieval structures that have date back to the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th century and earlier, it was just amazing. So we absolutely enjoyed that. And I won't lie, enjoyed a fair bit of local food and drink along the way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, sounds great. Sounds brilliant. So back to reality, back to the grind of designing buildings. And Peter, tell us what's your inspiration for this week's episode?
Inspiration for this week's episode. Well, look, in a sense, it doesn't have anything to do with the construction industry and nothing to do with engineering. But my wife and I were preparing dinner the other night, and we had the TV on in the background. And we don't watch the show regularly; it just happened to be running in the background. And it was one of those ambulance shows where the camera crew follows around a bunch of people in the ambulance, the paramedics, and attends with them as they go out to various callouts. And you could not help but be inspired by these amazing people who go out to these sometimes horrific situations and, they confront all manner of trauma. They meet people and deal with people who are in pain, going through fear, particularly, people who have suddenly got heart attack symptoms or something like that. And just seeing these absolute angels attend those scenes, put people at ease, attend to them, the care they show, you just couldn't help but be inspired by these amazing people. And I guess tying it back to the construction industry, there are some horrific injuries that occur on a construction site with people falling off scaffolds or, an injury with a tool. And we sometimes forget that there's that side of the industry, and these people turn up in an ambulance and take us off to hospital and look after us. So, look, I found that inspiring. Anyway, that was my amazing moment of the week.
So green roofs and particularly lightweight roofs, which I have been thinking about for a while, and I'll introduce the story this way. So I'm a licensed builder. I do inspections, and occasionally I inspect and provide advice to purchasers of property, and we provide planning advice, but general advice. So I went out and I gave advice to a couple who were buying a terrace house, and it did have a roof terrace and a lightweight roof terrace. And I just said, well, that's going to leak, and, you know, it'll probably leak there. And you know, sure enough, they bought it, something, we did some work on it, and it did leak. And the guy was like, oh, he just thought I was the smartest guy in the room because I told him it would leak. And it's not that I'm a house whisperer or a genius. The fact of the matter is they all, like, there's two types of roof terraces in a lightweight construction, the one that is leaking and the one that will leak. So it's not just that I'm, it's just the nature of the beast. It's so much to a point where I, well, as a licensed builder, I don't warrant lightweight terraces or lightweight roofs that are above a living zone because they're fraught. And I posted about it on LinkedIn, and I got, you know, some posts, LinkedIn's funny, some posts, no one says anything. And this one lit up engineers in LinkedIn who all have an opinion about green roofs and lightweight balconies and lightweight green, you know, lightweight terraces, because I just said they don't work. Well, you can't really build them in a way that warrant them. And we'll talk about why, but I'll pass over to you. I've talked enough, Andrew. We'll get your take on that story.
Well, I think it's funny. You've set the tone. You used the word, what was it, sad news and green roofs in the one sentence. So I suppose you've declared your hand there. Look, I think it's really interesting. We build our houses out of timber, concrete, clay bricks, steel, aluminium, glass and more. We use all these different materials and bring them together and they look pretty, but they all behave differently. Timber warps and shrinks, concrete shrinks, clay bricks grow and expand, steel changes with thermal changes, it expands and contracts, aluminium does its thing, and then you've got glass, which is brittle. And we bring all these things together, get out the hammer and the no more gaps and the sealies and all the rest of it. And then we act surprised when they all behave differently and move. And, you know, I think if you ever, you know this as well as I do, when you finish a project, you get the photographer in the very next day, because if he turns up a week later, it's all going to look different as these things move. And so I think good building, good design and good detailing is making provision for that movement with control joints and flashings and all the rest of it. And so balconies, terraces, roof terraces and green roofs are perhaps the real, at the pointy end of risk when we build them out of these things that move around so much and then act surprised when there's a leak or a water problem. And as you said, there's two sorts of roofs, ones that leak and ones that haven't leaked yet. It will come. And I think there's been tremendous improvements and changes in how we detail them, how we go about them. I think the awareness from contractors, and that shouldn't be lost either. You know, you and I as engineers and builders can talk about these things and have some knowledge, but it's actually the installers and the people that go out and are up the ladder and applying the Sikaflex and the sealants who probably need to hear a bit more about what goes on and how to do these things. So it's fraught with risk, but we can be clever about it. And, you know, maybe that's some of the things we can touch on in today's conversation, or just become more aware of what are the risks, what goes wrong, why does it go wrong, and how do you combat that?
Yeah, and I think, like, zooming out even further, which I like to do because I never think in a linear way, but zooming right out, just green roofs generally, like, I would only ever build a green roof or a roof terrace out of concrete, right? And the problem I have with the whole green roof, well, not industry, but just that whole green infrastructure movement, is it portrays to, it's all about climate and improving carbon pollution. And yet the minute you create a green roof, suddenly you're introducing from my perspective as a builder, it's got to be concrete. So the structure becomes concrete because concrete is actually an appropriate medium for green roofs, but it upspecs the whole building and upsizes everything, and concrete's more carbon intense. So I guess it kind of, you know, for me, it doesn't stack up as a carbon mitigating initiative. And not only that, but they're more expensive, they're more work to maintain, and it kind of just doesn't stack up. So I think, you know, if you're doing a green roof, do it for the right reasons. It's because you like greenery and you're happy to put a bit more effort and money and structure into it. And I just think a splash of green is easy to do on a 3D rendering, but actually the reality is quite different. And not only that, sometimes the outcome is very different to that render, where if you saw the original render and it's a wall of green and it's amazing, come back in 5 years and it's a couple of brown looking plants, right? Because there's a cost to maintenance and you need to be onto it. So even the smokestacks for the new WestConnex, you look at the renderings and then you look at the reality and half the plants are kind of looking a bit off and some of the plants are already dead, you know, a couple of years or a year later after opening. So you kind of, yeah, there's a lot there. But anyway, I feel like I've just added another layer to the conversation and maybe made it even more complicated.
It is multifaceted. And I think if you're a homeowner contemplating a green roof, or if you're an architect who's been asked to, you know, work one into the design, you've definitely got to build up a bit of a ledger of pros and cons and make sure, as you say, you're doing it for the right reasons. You know, and certainly if you go to Google and say, you know, what's great about a green roof, you'll get, you know, thousands of responses that come back that sell you all the pros. And some of them are very altruistic. Some of them, as you say, have a tremendous environmental tick in the sense that, yes, it's, you know, obviously having plants up there that, you know, are breathing and removing carbon dioxide are doing more for the environment than just a steel tin roof, no doubt about that. As the owner of the home, you've got something that can provide sound insulation to your roof. It can be a rainwater buffer. It can help with, it's obviously thermal mass and insulation, reduces the ambient temperature and the indoor temperature. You can argue that also then reduces energy costs with your heating and cooling of your house. It encourages biodiversity. It attracts wildlife, which may or may not be a good thing, depending on where you live and what wildlife you attract.
And how you feel about wildlife on your roof.
Yeah, exactly. But as you say, if you're going to do it right and you want a good long-term result, you are going to have to, well, you should be using a concrete slab that drives so many things into the discussion all of a sudden. You're right. If all you're doing is putting on the blinkers about embodied carbon and you know, carbon footprint on the construction, well, the moment you go to concrete, you're changing the ledger there somewhat. And then the other thing is it's cost. So, you know, people go to an architect and say, oh, you know, I'd love this design, please, and I've got this much to spend. And the moment you put a concrete roof on, you're just taking a lot of the budget just in the material cost before you even get to think about your nice tiles and your finishings and your joinery and all the rest of it. Concrete is heavy. It weighs a lot. So the moment you put a big concrete slab up at the roof, you've then got to have walls that can take that load. That load goes down to, say, for example, the suspended slab underneath that goes all the way down to the footings. And so every part of the structural component of the house has just had to be increased to carry the weight of that roof. And that's just to get it to stand up. Something to think about too. Let's just pause there for a moment and focus on that bit. Most green roofs, anyone who's in that space will tell you that you want a minimum of 300 mil of soil for whatever you plant up there to have a fighting chance. And, you know, a lot of people say you should have more than that, 400, 500 mil. Sometimes planning controls don't allow people to get the depth of soil that they'd like, you know, without losing head height clearance in the room underneath or whatever. But even a 300 mil soil bed, just to put turf, you know, lawn or grass up there, that's adding half a ton of dead weight in soil per square meter. So if you've got a terrace in Paddington or Balmain, Surrey Hills, and let's say it's 6 meters by 3.5 meters for the roof up there, that's 12 tons of soil that you've got to hold up in midair and suspend. So that's something to think about.
Yeah, and this is sold as a thing where it's a thermally efficient way to build, but that's only if you do it out of lightweight. Because the minute you introduce concrete, there's no practical way to create a thermal break. So, and concrete's actually not a very good insulator. So yes, the very top bit where it's full of soil and plants, and then you can put insulation, that's great. But you've always got an element of well, typically you've got an element of exposed beam or exposed concrete somewhere, and that's actually where you lose all your heat or gain, or whichever way you look at it, it's quite inefficient. So you've got, you know, and that's the irony with a lot of green roofs that are concrete. Yes, you've got insulation on top. You've got double glazed windows, but then you've got a beam that's got nothing because there's no practical way to put a thermal break into it. So actually, yeah, when you do the sums on the whole system, it doesn't always stack up, but it looks great. It looks amazing.
Yeah, for sure. But it comes back to what we said, that you've got to have a ledger and there's pros and cons on each side. And I think if you embark down this road, you need to be comfortable that everything on the pro side has outweighed what's on the other side. And cost and budget is a big thing. And, you know, the work that both our professions have got to go to, the builder and the engineer wearing my hat, the engineer's got to make it stand up, first of all. You've got to have a slab that can support that weight. And that's just the basic model with 300 mil of soil, as I say, you know, half a ton per square meter. That roof has then got to be drained. You know, you can't have saturated soil up there. So the moment you need to drain it, you've then got to think about the falls. You've then got to get the hydraulic stormwater engineer involved. The architect will be under pressure to drain that in a way that's elegant and eloquent, and, you know, often then try and hide the pipes and the plumbing in the walls and take that down. You've got to get that out. And this is the big thing, and you touched on it earlier, that everyone forgets about, is the M word, maintenance. You've got to get up there if it's a garden with actual plants, well, you've got to get up there and look after them so they don't just become, you know, weeds and a mess. How you get the access to that roof space isn't always practical or sensible. And a lot of people, a green roof is not a set and forget. And it's amazing how many architectural plans would come across my desk and you'd see this green roof, and when you'd start to have the conversation, you'd get told, oh, no, don't worry, we're just going to put some pot plants up there because everyone else realizes it can be too hard to do everything else.
So can a green roof, because this is the thing, right? And I think you and I have a little bit of a difference of opinion in how good concrete is. I think it's amazing. Like as an invention in the history of the world, concrete and its influence can't be understated. It's an incredible...
We have no difference of opinion on that front. Don't worry. I'm concrete's biggest fan and advocate.
Yeah. But I guess as to how durable and how watertight it is, you kind of mentioned that it's the other day that it's not as watertight as people think, whereas I actually think that it's more watertight than people think. So we should unpack that.
I think as long as you do the right things and take the right steps, you're absolutely correct. I guess the problem is, and I've been involved with a few remedial jobs, you see what happens when people don't do the right things with concrete, and then it's a drama. But yeah, all things being equal and if you go about the right way, 100% concrete is amazing in that respect.
Yeah, so I think maybe the difference in that opinion is between the concrete slabs that I've poured and then the concrete slabs that you've seen in the wild.
Well, you're a good builder and you do the right thing. Sadly, not all the building industry is blessed to have people as good as yourself doing it.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, it was interesting because I'm like, hang on a minute, I think it's amazing and you think that it's got its flaws. But I think, yeah, so I think that's the difference. It's got to be well poured. It's got to have good cover on the steel, which means that you've got enough concrete over the steel, over the steel reinforcement, so that over time moisture and air doesn't get into the steel. So cover is enough concrete essentially over the steel. So if you've got enough cover and you've poured it, you've got a good team and you've poured it well and you've set it up well, it's like a magical thing. It's in construction, concrete is magical because you go from this mass of steel and plywood and props and all like this jumble of things, and then suddenly you've got a deck to stand on. Like it's miraculous. And not only that, it's self-healing. To a point, right? The crystals in concrete keep growing. So after you pour it, you've got to keep it wet because the moisture, so that's why it's magical. The more moisture is in it and on it, the more the crystals grow inside it and it self-heals. And concrete in and of itself is reasonably waterproof. So for me, it's like the only way to build a roof deck above a living zone or a green roof. It's really the only viable option. But I started to think, and the post I put up on LinkedIn was, well, am I being too narrow-minded? Like, am I not thinking out, am I just stuck in my ways and am I not thinking through it? So I started to unpack, well, is it even possible to do lightweight green roofs? And, well, of course it's possible. Is it possible to do it in a way where they're durable and not an inherent maintenance issue? And you touched on why they're a maintenance, the reason they're a maintenance issue is because typically lightweight buildings have steel and timber and a bit of brick, you know, and a dash of PVC and whatever, and aluminium and whatever else. And the thing that happens is steel expands when it gets hot. When timber gets hot, it dries out and it shrinks. So that's the middle of summer. Steel expands, timber shrinks. In winter, what happens? Like, it gets damp. The timber absorbs moisture and grows. The steel shrinks. So over time, they tend to rip themselves to pieces, right? And you could sort of see it in a timber and steel structure that's been there for a while. And you apply a rigid waterproof membrane over the top. That membrane gets tugged in all directions all at once and gets broken, essentially. So, and that's before you even install a balustrade or put penetrations or do all the other things that come with modern buildings to make them compliant. So my question is, how do we? Is it even possible and viable to build a lightweight green roof?
Look, I think you just outlined all the issues and dramas and the risks, and they are really difficult to overcome. And it really comes down to the provision for movement, the membrane that's installed. How flexible is that membrane? Can the membrane, you know, roll with the punches? Most of them can't. Or if you have to go to the effort to make all that work, you're going down a very expensive route to do it properly. And for all sorts of reasons along the way, sometimes you know, those more expensive options to do it right are overlooked or bypassed, and you get the problem. I think the other thing also is that it's an issue is a lot of those things that you mentioned take time. It can take a year for four seasons to play out for some of that stuff to occur. So the builder finishes the job, they pour in the soil, put the plants, looks amazing, photographer comes up, looks unreal, hero shots go up on Instagram, big success, everyone gives themselves a pat on the back. And then a year later, you've had two summers, a winter, and all that thing has changed. And all of a sudden, the leak appears. And sometimes by that stage, the house may have changed hands. That's the other problem with these things. You know, so it might have been a development that the original owner who commissioned the job has now sold the property. Someone else has moved in and you know, 9 months later, this leak appears and all knowledge of what went up there and has been lost. And then, you know, they're not privy to that information. Or it just comes out over time. And there's so many, one of the great ironies in the building industry is for most homes in Australia, you know, the design period is 50 years. We as engineers have to design something that's going to stand there for 50 years. A lot of the products we use in the construction industry have warranties of a maximum of 20 years if you're lucky. And some of the membranes that we use on green roofs and balconies and all the rest of it have a 10 or 20 year warranty if you're lucky. And a lot of them are based on a maintenance thing. So you might get a 20 year warranty provided you rip everything up and maintain and reapply something at the 5 year mark or the 10 year mark. And again, if the house has changed hands in the meantime, well, that knowledge gets lost. And so, yeah, at the 20 year mark, well, you know, and we're seeing it now. We're seeing buildings that were done in the late 90s and the early 2000s who are, you know, now a lot of the stuff that went in has reached the end of its design life, its 20 year, you know, maintenance free period, and is now needing a bit of love. And green roofs certainly are more prone to displaying and showing some of those dramas as a result of movement or materials breaking down. You know, some of these things just deteriorate under UV light too. So it's amazing how many products come out of Europe and we use them here in Australia and our hot sun is no, they're just no match for it. So yeah, all these things. And so to get to your original premise, can we do these things in a lightweight? Look, we can, but I think it's fraught with danger. I think you are more likely to encounter problems. And all things being equal, if you've got the choice, you would opt for concrete each time because it will give you a more reliable long-term product and solution. Will it make all the problems go away? No, you've still got to deal with it. You've still got to detail accordingly. You know, there's something people have heard me say a lot of time, there are three certainties in life: death, taxes, and concrete will shrink. And when concrete shrinks, it cracks. And when it cracks, it's, depending on the crack, it's no longer waterproof. One of the great misconceptions that's come out in the last 5-10 years is people are becoming more and more aware of concrete waterproofing admixtures, you know, the likes of Zypex and Penetron and even Caltite that's been around for years. And everyone thinks that if you add these products to your concrete mix, she'll be right, mate, it's waterproof, no problems. And it's not as simple as that. Concrete will shrink if the engineer has not done his or her job correctly with the reinforcement and the detailing. You'll get high shrinkage strains, the slab cracks. And products like Zypex and Penetron, for example, only warrant their product for crack widths of 0.4 of a millimeter. And for a lot of roof slabs that are up there in the sun and getting baked and shrinking tremendously, you know, the cracks are wider than 0.4 of a mil. The Zypex or Penetron can no longer do its job and water is making its way through. And, you know, I think there's been a few projects where architects have been caught out because they wanted to express the concrete. They didn't want to have a false ceiling underneath. And, you know, what you're seeing now, those ferrous stains pop out down the bottom through what are only hairline cracks, but it's occurring because what's happening up top is more than the waterproofing admixture allowed for. So I think as part of a good green roof solution, you would want to be relying more on just the concrete itself. I think you would want a separate membrane in addition to everything else that you're doing to combat the risk of water coming into an internal habitable space.
Yeah, I agree. And I wasn't advocating for a minute that you just rely on the concrete. I guess I was outlining the properties of concrete. I wasn't advocating for not putting membranes in. I certainly think you need membranes, but certainly the point being that concrete is more forgiving. If a membrane, even if a membrane was to fail, the concrete is a secondary barrier typically, right? If a lightweight structure fails, the secondary barrier really is the gyp rock on your ceiling.
Yeah.
And so pretty soon you start seeing some staining. But I wonder if we were to design a lightweight green roof, what does that look like? Maybe it's a different sort of thing than what we used to. And the way I've got around the problem of lightweight, green areas or green roofs is that I've treated them like a roof first and foremost, and then put planters up on top of that to make them serviceable, but make them function as a roof for all intents and purposes, and then tied in some removable pots, or be it large square, you know, or large rectangular pots. But I think that's probably the only way that I've moved through that is I've gone, well, let's treat it like any roof and then isolate the green part from it, right, and have an air gap between the two. But I think it's the struggle normally is space. And, you know, timber's obviously going to be thicker than concrete. Concrete, 200 mils is a concrete slab for a typical building, right, to support a green roof. The minute you move to timber, it's a whole different beast. And 200 mil for concrete, that's all of it. That can be the linings, you know, as you said, from the underside. All you need is an express concrete slab. And in fact, that's a desired finish. And above, you just add your, well, potentially insulation, drainage soil. But the structural and the cladding element is 200 mil. Timber's different. And that's one of the things. Do you have a rule of thumb for what to allow for timber, I guess, floor between the ceiling and the roof?
Yeah, if someone came along and said, hey, I need you to hold up 12 tons of soil on the roof, well, the first thing that does not come into my mind is, hey, let's use some radiator pine joists up there. you know, and the other thing too is, Ben, people forget this, you know, timber is prone to long-term creep deflection. So you load a timber joist up and it deflects, that's great, but it keeps on deflecting for the next 10, 20 years after that. Now, concrete can do that as well if you're not careful about how you detail your concrete. But, you know, that can lead to ponding exercises on a green roof. So all of a sudden in the middle of the joist where the joists, timber joists might be bowing the most, you've then started to collect water because the water's not draining in the direction that it was supposed to be. That then adds more dead weight. I mean, you know, ponding snowballs upon itself. So that's an issue you've got to deal with as well. But, you know, for a typical roof, let's say, to answer your question, let's say we were putting a green roof over a room below that was, for the sake of this conversation, let's say 4 meters by 5 meters. To achieve that with a heavy roof, you're looking at a 300 mil joist minimum. And, you know, it'd be an engineered timber, like an LVL or something like that. So, yeah, 300 mil joist, then you've got your ceiling underneath that. So let's say another maybe battens and 13 mil gyprock. So you've added another 30 mil there already. And then on top, you've got your substrate. So, yeah, as you say, you'd put, you know, I know most builders might put plywood down first and then some sort of FC sheeting on top of that, set that. You then got to allow for your fall. So how do you do that? You then put a deadweight screed on that so that you can actually get things to fall before you then come to your membrane. So, yeah, we've probably got to at least 400 mil there just in structure as opposed to your 200 thick concrete slab.
And how many times has an architect shown 400 mils in a structural, like in a green roof or any sort of floor or ceiling?
It's pretty rare, my friend, pretty rare. I make this joke at some presentations I do, but I think some academic went through, and this is not a knock at architects, please. It shouldn't be interpreted that way.
We can knock architects.
Oh, I try not to. They're my best friends. But anyway, yeah, I'm convinced that some academic went through all the universities and the architectural faculties 50, 60 years ago and told them all that a floor zone should be 300 mil deep, because every set of architectural drawings I get for a two-story house or a first floor addition, they seem to allow 300 mil for the floor zone from the ceiling of the ground floor to the top of the first floor, and everything's got to squeeze into that 300. And that may have worked 50, 60 years ago when we all had small rooms, you know, a small dining room, a small kitchen, all the rest of it. And with open plan living now and much larger rooms, particularly in larger houses, you need deeper structure to span those distances. And, 300, I keep saying to people, if you've only got 300 mil, by the time you take off your particle board flooring on top, your ceiling underneath and battens and all the rest of it, you've probably left the engineer to a 240 mil maybe for the depth of joist to span across. And a 240 joist can probably do 4.5 meters. So if the room is 5-6 meters across, you're in trouble already. So that rule of thumb of 300 mil that all the architects are working to, as I say, probably great 50 years ago, but they do need to increase that spec with what we do these days, I'm afraid.
A lot of the architects I've worked with, like, they didn't even read that rule of thumb. They're well below 300. I'm not won't point any fingers, but they're like, surely it can be 200, right? What's wrong with 200? You can make that work. Engineers can work it out.
Well, everyone's chasing increased ceiling heights. We like high ceilings now, don't we? And that means you've got to take it out of
we
something.
Like high ceilings.
It comes out of the floor zone
and low roofs.
Yeah,
because we're trying to keep our roofs down. So yeah, I think there's pressure. There's natural pressure to lift the ceiling so it's not, as our head of architecture at Ballast Point says, not to be so mean. You need to lift the ceiling up, otherwise it feels really mean. So you want to push. But then, you know, from above, there's pressure to pushing down because it could be the height of the building. It could be overshadowing. There's planning pressure to push that roof down and or heritage for whatever it is, you know, trying to keep it below the ridge line of the existing building. So yeah, there's pressure pushing up, there's pressure all around, and the engineer's stuck in the middle. And by the way, we can make fun of everyone here, builders, architects, engineers. There's no sacred cows on Buildopedia. We'll laugh at them all and ourselves, hopefully.
Very good. Yeah.
I'm wondering, what if we did a building and we just didn't put timber in it? What if we just used steel? What if we used steel posts, steel beams, steel rafters? How much does that help? Or is that still, like, how much of green roof, how much of, well, when I say green roof, I'm lumping in roof terraces as, you know, any roof terrace that's lightweight gets lumped in with that lot because they're all the same. They all fail. So how much would just doing it in steel, because then you don't have that differential, but, you know, be it timber and steel, clay brick and concrete brick, which is another disaster that I've seen where you mix the two and one shrinks and one grows and the wall tears itself to pieces. What if we made it all uniform? Would that solve a lot of the problems that we see?
Well, look, it would get rid of some of the problems and maybe introduce a few others. Steel's obviously also got the problem of being very prone to corrosion. So if you've got express steelwork or external steelwork, you've got to somehow deal with that. And, you know, everyone says, oh, no worries at all, just hot dip galvanize it. But I don't know too many architects who'd like to see hot dip galvanized steel everywhere around their beautiful roof as it looks out over Vaucluse. So, you know, if you've got to combat those things as well. And I think this is the beauty and the curse of building a house, you know, from the moment of conception and architectural design to the day the builder hammers in the last nail, it's a game of conflict. And I say that in a nice way, but there's compromise along the way between how much the client wants to spend, what is the product, how does the engineer make it work, does it work in a long-term situation? You just touched on it earlier, you know, how do you get maximum ceiling height when you also got things coming down from above? It's an absolute kaleidoscope of conflicting pressures and forces in the wants and needs columns versus, you know, the realities of costs and behavior versus planning rules versus what an architect likes, what people think is subjectively attractive and beautiful, to what can practically be done on the particular site with access and materials, all these conflicting things that pull at one another. And that's the joy of building. And anyone who's gone through a renovation or built their own home knows what that experience is like. It's an interesting space. And you know, you and I have touch points at various points along the way in that journey and lend our guidance and expertise. But we're all part of a very big complex machine so that Mar and Par Kettle can move into the house at the end of the job, hopefully with a nice working leak-proof green roof on top of their heads.
Yeah, but okay, so unpacking, I want to push a little bit harder on steel building because I think it is a little bit more practical and I've seen things even in the inner west of Sydney, in our area that I haven't seen before, which is buildings framed out of steel. So if you, in theory, say, yeah, of course, corrosion is an issue, but say you water, you know, say you clad it, insulated it, membraned it, and I'm not even going to get into, we could do a whole episode on systems that work in Europe but fail in Australia, so we won't even get into that, but what if you could clad and waterproof? Does that help? Is that a way forward? And it's not the whole solution because you still got to fix a balustrade somehow, and that's a point that's always such a painful thing. In, you know, you've got this deck, you've got an, you know, you've sealed it, you've got waterproofing. Now, how do you attach the balustrade? Right. Because the obvious way is to screw through the membrane that you've just,
yes,
that's holding water out and put a hole in it. But putting those other things aside, just is it more if the building shrinks, because it will presumably just shrink altogether. And so how much, I guess, what's your gut feel? How much of it is that theory of different materials ripping the building to bits and differential in movement? How much of it is differential in movement and how much of it is just move shrinkage and growing? Like, you know, I'm not trying to get your kind of like gut feel with your experience in materials and seeing things fail over the years. How much of it is differential and how much of it is just shrinkage and growth?
Well, I think, but put it in context, we're having this conversation around green roofs, which means it's up on top of the house and it's exposed. So it's therefore subject to the extremes of climate. So it's getting baked in the hot Aussie sun, it's cooling in winter, you're getting the wet drying phenomenon going through. So, you know, in an ideal wet green roof, your timber would never get wet, of course, but wetting and drying to timber is not great. So if your green roof features a barge board or parts that are the part of the balustrade, they're going to expand and contract with the heat and the moisture. So, you know, if you switch to everything being in steel, I guess you've eliminated that risk straight away. again, we're dealing with heavy loads here with a green roof. So, you know, the engineer is probably going to have steel beams around the place anyway. So for a lot of roofs, you might have a couple of primary steel beams that fly across from one side of the house to the other. And in this scenario, which is very hypothetical, I might add, you'd have timber joists spanning between those steel beams. And so that steel and timber is going to behave differently. So in your model here, where it's all steel, if you've got steel joists or rafters spanning into a steel primary beam, again, yes, you've eliminated that differential behavior from a thermal point of view, which can only be a good thing. So the more movement you eliminate from the system, the less likely you are to tear a membrane. So yeah, there's certainly, the theory stacks up. You know, there's mileage in this design if you wanted to chase the rabbit down the hole. But as we've touched on, other things then start to come into play. You know, there'll be architects and homeowners who have a mindset about the carbon footprint, and timber will win that battle every day over steel. So you've got to overcome that point of view. Steel is expensive compared to timber. So again, you've affected the budget. You've got to overcome that hurdle. And then you've got the builder who's going to want to do things their own way as well. And gosh, I don't know how many times I've detailed, you know, what I believe to be a brilliant solution on my drawings, and the builder comes back and says, oh, mate, can I do it this way instead? How come? Oh, because that's why I always do it, and I'm comfortable doing it that way. So, you know, you can do everything in your specification and then find the builder on the day it changes things anyway. So, look, yeah, to your point, it's you could explore that, and I know the way you like to think, and I suspect you'll ponder that and probably come up with a great solution in due course. But it's an uphill climb to get all parts of the building industry to become aligned on how to go about it.
Yeah, I think one thing about timber is that it's not as cheap as it used to be. So, like I said, when you drive around, you suddenly see terraces framed out of metal, like which I've never seen before. I've seen houses framed out of metal, but not, you know, in a West development. And when you see the whole building roof and every part of it framed in metal, you're like, something. And it seems like a speculative development. You go, well, they know something about it. You know, if developers know, like, if there's a cheaper way to build, they'll be onto it quicker than anyone else. So yeah, there's something in that in and of itself.
You're right, and what it is, it's prefab. You know, one of the great things about steel is you can have these steel frames, particularly, like, you know, simple wall studs, like a wall frame in studs. And, you know, TrueCore are working hard in this space at the moment. If you can have all that stuff prefabbed off-site, delivered and craned up, you've sped up, as you know, time is money on a building site, and the faster you can get something up, the cheaper it'll be. So no surprises that there's developers and builders going more and more down that route. Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah. So I guess what's the conclusion, or what have we missed? We've gone down some pretty deep rabbit holes.
Well, I think we've talked about the issues and dramas of a lightweight concrete roof. We could probably round things out just by looking at some of the things to avoid with a concrete one. And as you said before, concrete's amazing. You put the formwork and the Rio up, you pour it, and, you know, a day or two later, you've got something to stand on and walk on. That's great. But the engineer and the builders and the concreters on the day still have to give due regard to a few things. So sadly, there's a few engineers who tend not to give too much thought about concrete shrinkage and crack control. A lot of engineers do their design to make sure the slab is strong enough. They make sure it's stiff enough so it won't deflect, and then they stop there and move on to the next part of the project. And sometimes we as a profession can be guilty of not thinking about the long-term, even the short-term shrinkage, the drying shrinkage, and putting enough reinforcement in to combat that. So, you know, the engineer's got to be cognizant of the shape of the slab, how regular or irregular it is, and then make sure that there's appropriate trimmer bars and a sufficient level of reinforcement to control the shrinkage cracking. That goes a long way to making sure that the membrane will stay healthy on top for the green roof. The other side that then comes is the strength and durability of the concrete. And this is where, again, engineers have to be careful. If you go to a higher strength concrete, you are getting a more durable product in theory. So if you up your roof slab from 32 MPa concrete to 40 MPa concrete, in theory, you're getting a stronger, more durable, and therefore, in a sense, watertight concrete. However, the more you go up in concrete strength, the more shrinkage strains you get. So you go from 32 MPa to 40 MPa. You've also just increased the amount of shrinkage, which means you have to increase the amount of Rio you throw at it to combat the shrinkage. And not a lot of engineers are mindful of that. So that's something to think about as well. And these are some of the reasons why then adding the additive, the admixture, you know, your Penetron or Zypex can be, look, I think it should be your last line of defense rather than your first line, but make sure that's in the mix as well. Getting to the construction of it on the day, you've touched it on already, pour the concrete, that's only half the job. You've got to cure it. And sadly, a lot of builders just don't allow the time to cure it properly, to keep it wet, you know, to put the plastic or the hessian on and keep it wet for 7 days so that it cures nicely. Sometimes, particularly in the heat of summer, you've really got to watch that. And if builders aren't on top, the concrete cures and dries out too quickly. You get the tremendous shrinkage cracking as a result. So we've got to be mindful of that. There's a lot of things you've got to get right on the day of the pour and in the days following the pour to get best practice and to make sure that the concrete is not going to move around and shrink as much. And therefore, that has implications for the health of the membrane that you eventually put on top. And people forget about this, but concrete shrinks for 30 years. You've got to take that 30-year mindset into account. And yes, the majority of it happens in the first 12 months, and most of that happens in the first 6 months, and most of that much happens in the first 3 months. You know, it's a parabolic curve, but it will keep moving for 30 years. And so you've got to come up with systems and detailing that can accommodate that, or choose your membranes and how you detail and install those membranes to cope with that movement. So those are some of the things to think about. I think just simply saying, let's do it in concrete is you've got to do more than just specify concrete to get the best outcome for your green roof. But again, getting back to something we touched on at the start of the conversation, as an engineer, if you're telling me I've got to hold up a few tons of weight up there, yes, absolutely, I'll opt for concrete each time before we even think about some of the issues you've touched on just with being able to rely on it to keep inside watertight.
Well, that's a good, I mean, that in and of itself is a concrete 101 and an introduction to what to look out for, which is great. But as always, which one is the most important? My gut feel, and I've seen a lot of concrete pours, dealt with a lot of concrete and a lot of concrete where it's just concrete and the ceiling, the finish is concrete below. There's no room for error. So you become very good at work or making sure you avoid shrinkage because you can't hide it. And you do. I mean, you do get shrinkage and you do get micro cracking, but nothing. I mean, touch wood. I can't recall when we've had that sort of an issue where we started getting moisture through a crack. And the beauty of concrete, like when you do get moisture moving through it, that moisture creates crystal growth in the concrete, which tends to seal itself up. But yeah, I'm just curious. There are all these factors. My gut feel is that the curing is, if you get one thing right, get the curing right. That's from my experience. Well, sorry, compaction is important in the way you vibrate concrete. Yeah, because the minute if you've got big voids in there, you're stuffed. So assuming you've got a good concrete crew who it doesn't over vibrate, which that is a problem in and of itself, because then all the aggregate settles to the bottom and it isn't evenly distributed. But if you've got a competent concrete crew, the thing that really makes the biggest difference, I think, is curing and letting it cure slowly rather than cure violently. But I wonder what your, you know, sure, all those are factors, but I kind of tend to think from a perspective of, okay, if you only get a chance to get one thing right, because you're going to, what is that thing, right? Because I come from a more pragmatic approach. As a builder, you've got so many things happening. And as a small builder, you cannot do what a big builder does, where they have a person who's in charge of quality and they got a big list of things to tick off. And so the rational approach to quality for a smaller builder is get the most important things right first and foremost, and then deal with the other things. Because the problem with those big checklists of things that can go wrong when they're exhaustive they can distract you from the biggest, most important things. So if you've got a big quality checklist to get through, you might not get to the most important item because you might be distracted halfway through. So my approach to quality is first, get the best people. That's the first most important thing. The second one is the biggest things, the biggest points of failure and the most likely points of failure. Focus on those. And then things tend to fall in behind that. But
100%.
Yeah, what is the most important thing to get right?
Control what you can control. In this discussion, you've got to assume that everything's worked right along the way. For example, when the concrete truck turns up, you've got to hope that the truckie didn't pull over to one side of the road and put a whole stack of water into the back off with his hose so it goes down the line better. That happens. And the build, you can have the best build in the world. The builder's not going to know what the concrete truck driver did on the way there. If it's a stinking hot day and he's got a 40 MPA mix in the back of the agitator, there's a good chance he may have added a bit of water on the way, and that's going to work against you. So, you know, you've got to hope that things like that don't happen. You're right. You've got to have a good crew there on the day who know how to compact their concrete properly. You've got to hope that the Rio was tied down properly so that when everyone's trampling all over and dragging the pump across, that the Rio doesn't get displaced or kick up and compromise cover. You touched on cover a bit earlier in the conversation, but again, that's another long-term issue. If that cover gets compromised, if the builders trample all over it, kick a bit of steel close to the surface and it's only got 10, 15 mil cover, well, that's a ticking time bomb for corrosion, which is going to lead to spalling. And then the nasty C word turns up, concrete cancer. That's going to then fail the membrane down the track as well. So you've got to combat against that. So what can you can control? And one of the things you can definitely control is your curing. It's for an exposed roof slab, and certainly one that's then going to hold a green roof. You don't want to rely on one of those simple sprays where you pour the concrete and the guy turns up the next day and applies the spray and walks away. You do want that full, as you say, the slow curing process. Follow best practice and you can hope for the best results. But you know, let's not beat ourselves up too much about this. Concrete's a dark art, and you can do everything in the book and follow best practice and tick every box, and the bastard will still crack and fail you anyway. That's the joy and the curse of concrete.
Well, it is. It's a chemical reaction that you're doing in a plywood box, right?
Like, yeah.
It's an experiment. it's a science experiment that you've built a plywood box for, and it's a chemical reaction happening that you hope goes well. And it's in the environment, and it's got lots of people along the way. But I think still, I think I would sum up that a bad concrete slab is better than the best timber-framed green roof that I've ever seen. Like, you know, a compromise, yeah, you got.
In the context of this, I suspect you're right.
Yeah.
There's another side too, and just coming back to your point about some of these houses we're seeing now where the ceiling is the off-form concrete slab. You know, there's nowhere to hide. I've been involved in projects over time where another step you can do to combat things is to make sure all the Rio is hot dip galvanized so that if water does come through the matrix, it doesn't then pick up the brown ferrous staining and come through. You know, you can look up at the soffit of the slabs and see the brown stains in the hairline crack. So we can try and combat that with galvanizing our Rio. But then again, you've just added a lot of cost as well. So again, it's the combat. You know, what's the best solution versus what the client's prepared to pay for?
So where did we end up today?
I think we've had a great discussion about green roofs. Well, I think what we've highlighted here is there's a lot to think about. I think there's a lot more to it than an architect just putting on the drawing and saying green roof or you know, shading the roof green and putting that on the DA plans and say, okay, everyone else go away and work that out. It's a multi-pronged thing to talk about. And I think like all good projects and all good solutions, I think if the architect, the builder, and the engineer and the client all have the wonderful four-way conversation, which doesn't happen often enough in our profession, I might add, that's going to lead to the best outcomes. And like anything, it's about managing expectations. But I think if nothing else, today we've highlighted the pros, the cons, the tricks, the traps, the tips, and how to go about it. And with a bit of luck, anyone who goes to Google and says, how do I go about a green roof? Maybe this podcast might turn up in the Google results and they can get some good advice listening to it.
Yeah, and I think as a licensed builder, I just can't warrant a lightweight terrace or lightweight green roof that is above a living zone. Like, it's just not viable. It's just not, the risk is too much. So I guess if a client came to me and said, I'm really passionate about a lightweight green roof, I would workshop it with someone like you, Andrew, from scratch and try and come up, but I would want leeway in the design. And even then I'd be pretty hesitant. But I'd want it to be, you know, the thing that I wouldn't compromise on. And the way we've solved, even though I can't warrant a green roof or a roof terrace above a living area that's built in lightweight, we have kind of found some solutions, and one of them is to make it serviceable. So we create the fall under the membrane, so the membrane is able to be inspected. So what we do is we put whatever's going on top sits on pedestals, and you're able to pull, if it's pavers or pots or whatever, it's something that can be removed, the membrane inspected periodically. So that's the only way I would do it. But I'd be even hesitant to do it that way, because as I said before, you still have to find a way to fix a balustrade. And the only way, a reasonable way to fix a balustrade with any certainty is to screw it to, or fix it mechanically to something that is under the membrane by definition. So that's the conundrum. So, yeah.
I think you touched on something that's really important there. You've got to warrant it. And I think, sadly, I think there's a lot of unfortunate builders who've been handed a poison chalice with a specification for a roof that really was probably never going to work. I was just helping out a builder the other day, literally the other day, a week or two ago, and it's another house that we talked about earlier where the concrete roof slab is the ceiling. It is everything. It's got a leak. The architect did not specify a membrane, didn't want a membrane. It's now leaking, and all of a sudden it's the builder's fault, and I'm not sure that's appropriate. I think the specification was wrong in the first place, and yet the builder's off in the firing line for problems that weren't of their making. So, yeah, you're right. You've got to warrant it, and that's something to think about. All part of that conversation at the start of the job, as you say. We had a technical glitch and had to deal with a sound issue, so we're now back just in time for the outro. Matt's sound is not working, so he's disappeared and thrown the ball to me to give the outro. So we hope you've enjoyed this conversation about green roofs. Hopefully you've picked up a few points along the way. I know at the end of each episode of Builderpedia, Matt likes to say, what are three key points? If I could come up with three very quickly off the top of my head, I guess one is, if you're going to have a green roof, ask the question straight away, is it going to be lightweight or concrete? And I think you've probably picked up from today's conversation that certainly a builder and engineer here are both advocating concrete is a more reliable way to go down that track. I think the second thing is to have the conversations with all the stakeholders, client, architect and builder, to an engineer, I should say, to come up with the ideal solution, the right specification and detailing. Think about maintenance, think about drainage. What are you going to do in the long term? If you're going to sell the property 2 or 3 years later, make sure the new owners know what's going on up there and how to go about that. And then the third thing is all the important things to do on the day of the construction, certainly if it's concrete, on the day of the pour. Watch for the weather. Make sure the engineer has detailed the steel correctly. Make sure the people doing the work up top are following best practice. And when it comes to best practice, make sure you do your curing as best as you possibly can and follow the old ways, keep the slab wet for 7 days. And that would be how to go about it. So I'm not used to doing the outros. I hope I've covered the basics of it there. But thank you very much. And we look forward to your company again on the next episode of Builderpedia after this. Signing out, this is Andrew on behalf of Matt. And we'll talk to you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Builderpedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, builderpedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.